British and American cannon were exchanging fire. The American guns, commanded by young Captain Alexander Hamilton. But again, as at Newark, when the British troops pressed on to the town the next morning, they found that the Americans had taken off. Washington had decided what must be done. He was heading for Trenton. It being impossible to oppose them with our present force, with the least possible prospect of success, he informed Congress, we shall retreat to the west bank of the Delaware. When we left Brunswick, wrote Nathaniel Greene, we had not 3,000 men, a very pitiful army to trust the liberties of America on. The hour had never looked darker. The Post Road, or King's Highway, from Brunswick to Trenton, the main thoroughfare between New York and Philadelphia, was as straight and flat and fine a 30-mile stretch of road as any in the country, and the retreating army made good time. The retreat was not at a run. It was a forced march, not a rout, as sometimes portrayed. Washington and the main body of the army, marching through the night, reached Trenton on the Delaware the morning of December 2nd, having left Lord Stirling and two brigades as a rear guard at the little college town of Princeton. Orders were issued to round up all boats along the east bank of the Delaware and to destroy any that could not be used, to keep them out of enemy hands. Among the delegates to Congress, the distances from Brunswick to Trenton and Trenton to Philadelphia were well known. And so if Cornwallis was at Brunswick, then he and his army were a mere 60 miles from Philadelphia. The inhabitants of Princeton and Trenton are evacuated, wrote Massachusetts delegate Robert Treat Paine. The people left them on Sunday night with panic and precipitation. People in Philadelphia were getting out, too, many taking all the possessions they could carry. Numbers of families loading wagons, a citizen recorded. All shops ordered shut. People in confusion of all ranks. The great question on everyone's mind was where were Lee and his men? It was said they were not far, close in the rear of the enemy. But no one knew. I have not heard a word from General Lee since the 26th of last month, John Hancock read in a letter from Washington, dated December 3rd. With his brother Sir William's campaign succeeding splendidly in New Jersey, and the war rapidly losing support among the people there, Admiral Lord Howe decided to make yet another appeal for conciliation. Signed also by Sir William, the new proclamation was their boldest, most generous gesture thus far, they felt. It was issued in the spirit of their obligation, as commissioned by the king, to serve as peace negotiators as well as military commanders, but also because Lord Howe genuinely believed that a negotiated settlement with the Americans was yet possible and vastly preferable to a long drawn-out conflict. He had no desire to lose any more British lives or to inflict any more destruction and suffering on the Americans than necessary. The proclamation, dated November 30th, was an immediate success. It offered all who within 60 days would come forth and take an oath of allegiance to the king and pledge their peaceable obedience a free and general pardon, and that they would reap the benefit of His Majesty's paternal goodness in the preservation of their property, the restoration of their commerce, and the security of their most valuable rights, under the just and most moderate authority of the Crown and Parliament of Britain. Hundreds, eventually thousands in New Jersey, flocked to the British camps to declare their loyalty. Considering the way the war was going, the size and might of the British Army, and the pathetic state of Washington's meager band, it seemed the prudent thing to do. As a farmer near Brunswick named John Bray wrote to a kinsman, "You can come down and receive protection and return home without molestation on the part of the king's troops, and you best know the situation of the provincial army. Do advise Cousin Johnny and Thomas and Cousin Thomas Jones, for if they do stay out to the last, they will undoubtedly fare the worst." Having crossed the Raritan and occupied Brunswick on December 1st, Cornwallis called a halt, as he had been ordered by General Howe. For 6 days, 6 merciful days for Washington and his army, the British and the Hessians made no move, a decision that puzzled, even infuriated, many of the British and local Loyalists, who saw no reason to let up on the chase. Called on to explain later, Cornwallis would say his troops were exhausted, footsore, hungry, and in need of rest. More important, it had not seemed at the time that excessive haste was wise or necessary. There were dangers in too rapid a pursuit. He worried about General Lee, who was variously reported just ahead or coming up from behind. But had it looked like he could catch Washington, Cornwallis said, he would have kept going, whatever the risks, no matter the orders. Some would see the pause as a horrendous blunder and blame William Howe. Captain Charles Stedman, one of Cornwallis's own officers and the earliest British historian of the war, would speculate that had Cornwallis been allowed to act at his own discretion, he would have pursued the weakened and alarmed enemy to the Delaware, over which, without falling into his hands, they never could have passed. But this assumed that Washington and the army could not have escaped down the east side of the river, which seems unreasonable. The Hessian officer, Johann Ewald, an intelligent and experienced soldier, concluded that Cornwallis had no desire to put his valuable troops in needless jeopardy. On the night of the capture of Fort Lee, when Ewald and his Jaegers had started after a column of rebels retreating in a cloud of dust, Cornwallis had ordered them back. "Let them go, my dear Ewald, and stay here," Cornwallis had said. "We do not want to lose any men. One Jaeger is worth more than 10 rebels. By the time of the halt at Brunswick, Ewald wrote, the hope of the whole British command was of ending the war amicably, without shedding the blood of the king's subjects in a needless way. Others would say it was for political reasons, related to the latest peace move, that Cornwallis intentionally let Washington get away. No one would ever prove this, and it seems unlikely. And especially since General Howe, sensing that a final blow might now indeed be struck, arrived at Brunswick on December 6th with an additional brigade commanded by General Grant, and ordered the advance to continue at once. The weather turned unseasonably warm, ideal for campaigning. A Loyalist newspaper in New York had already set the scene in a report published the day before. It is said by some persons who have lately seen the rebel forces that they are the most pitiable collection of ragged, dispirited mortals that ever pretended to the name of an army. And if the weather continues fair, but a little longer, there is no visible impediment to His Majesty's troops in completing a march to the capital of Pennsylvania. Everything seemed to the advantage of the conquering army. All was going as wished, except for one vexing problem that had been growing steadily worse for several weeks. Marauding and pillaging by redcoats and Hessians had gotten out of hand. "Scandalous behavior for British troops," wrote Major Stephen Kemble, the Loyalist serving with the British Army, "and the Hessians outrageously licentious and cruel to such a degree as to threaten with death all such as dare obstruct them in their depredations." Kemble had recorded this in his diary in early November, before the capture of Fort Washington. "I shudder for New Jersey," he had written. The plenty of New Jersey, the garden of America, its broad, fertile, well-tended farms, abundant supplies of livestock, grain, hay, food put up for winter, barrels of wine and beer for the taking, were all too much to resist. On the first night his Hessian troops set foot in New Jersey, Captain Ewald wrote, "All the plantations in the vicinity were plundered, and whatever the soldiers found in the houses was declared booty." Ewald was appalled by what he saw. "On this march through New Jersey we looked upon a deplorable sight. The region is well cultivated with very attractive plantations, but all their occupants had fled, and all the houses had been or were being plundered and destroyed." The British blamed the Hessians. "The Hessians are more infamous and cruel than any," wrote Ambrose Searle after hearing reports of British plundering. "The Hessians blame the British. the Americans blamed both the British and the Hessians, as well as the New Jersey Loyalists, and the British and Hessian commanders seemed no more able to put a stop to such excesses than Washington had been. The stories, amplified as many may have been, were a searing part of a war that seemed only to grow more brutal and destructive. Accounts of houses sacked, of families robbed of all they had, became commonplace. American reports of atrocities were often propaganda, but many were also quite accurate. The Pennsylvania Journal, the Pennsylvania Evening Post, and the Freeman's Journal carried reports of the sick and elderly being abused, of rape and murder. No one was safe, according to the British officer Charles Stedman. The friend and the foe from the hand of rapine shared alike. The New Jersey Loyalists were the most villainous of all, Nathaniel Greene reported to his wife, Katie. They lead the relentless foreigners to the houses of their neighbors and strip poor women and children of everything they have to eat or wear. And after plundering them in this sort, the brutes often ravish the mothers and daughters and compel the fathers and sons to behold their brutality. The enemy's ravages in New Jersey exceed all description, Greene would report to Governor Nicholas Cook of Rhode Island. Many hundred women ravished. At Newark, according to the report of a congressional committee, three women, one of whom was in her 70s, another pregnant, were most horribly ravished. Fear and outrage spread across New Jersey and beyond. Their footsteps are marked with destruction wherever they go, Greene said of the enemy. What remained of Washington's army, the Shadow Army, as Greene called it, was pitiful to behold. But give me leave to tell you, sir, Greene would write to John Adams, that our difficulties were inconceivable to those who were not eyewitnesses to them. British and Hessian forces got underway from Brunswick on December 7th and came on faster than ever, William Howe having decided that the possession of Trenton was extremely desirable. With the continuing success of the proclamation of November 30th, and hardly any opposition from the rebels, Howe intended to secure another large part of New Jersey, where Loyalists were plentiful, and where, as he also said, Philadelphia was in easy striking distance. Washington was on his way from Trenton to look things over at Princeton when he received word of the enemy's strength and rapid advance. Immediately he turned back. "Our retreat should not be neglected for fear of consequences," advised Nathaniel Greene, who had also ridden to Princeton earlier in the day. In the trek across New Jersey, Washington had become increasingly dependent on Greene. But it was beyond doubt that the enemy was advancing, Greene reported. Lord Stirling expected them by noon. Lee was also said to be at the heels of the enemy. But Greene cautioned Washington that whatever happened, Lee ought to be kept under control, within the lines of some general plan, or else his operations will be independent of yours. Washington had already made his decision, and he calmly, deliberately carried it out. A fleet of boats was standing ready at Trenton. By nightfall, the weary troops and their commander were crossing the Delaware to the Pennsylvania shore, where bonfires had been set ablaze to light the way. One of those watching from the Pennsylvania side was the artist Charles Wilson Peel, who had arrived with a Philadelphia militia unit in answer to Washington's call for help. Peel wrote later of the firelight on the river and shore, of boats laden with soldiers, horses, cannon, and equipment, of men calling out orders. It was a grand but dreadful spectacle. The hallooing of hundreds of men in their difficulties getting horses and artillery out of the boats made it rather the appearance of hell than any earthly scene. The long retreat that had begun in New York and continued from the Hudson to the Delaware was over. Casualties had been few in New Jersey, and its pitiable appearance and miseries notwithstanding, the army, or the semblance of an army, had once again survived. "With a handful of men we sustained an orderly retreat," wrote Thomas Paine in The Crisis, which soon appeared in Philadelphia. "No sign of fear was to be seen," he insisted. "Once more we are collected and collecting, by perseverance and fortitude, we have the prospect of a glorious issue. Henry Knox, writing on the morning of December 8th, his first letter to his wife in weeks, said she might be surprised to find he was in Pennsylvania. Though physically exhausted, he, like Payne, refused to be downcast. "It was a combination of unlucky circumstances that had brought things to such a pass," he told her. "We are now making a stand on the side of the Delaware toward Philadelphia." In truth, men were dreadfully dispirited. Many had given up, in addition to the 2,000 who had refused to sign on again after December 1st. Hundreds had deserted. Many of those left were sick, hungry, altogether as miserable as they appeared. To Charles Wilson Peel, walking among them by the light of the next morning on the Pennsylvania shore, they looked as wretched as any men he had ever seen. One had almost no clothes. He was in an old, dirty blanket jacket, his beard long, and his face so full of sores that he could not clean it. So disfigured was he that Peel failed at first to recognize that the man was his own brother, James Peel, who'd been with the Maryland unit as part of the rear guard. That the enemy might cross the Delaware at one or several points and move quickly to seize Philadelphia, as they had New York, no one doubted. On Washington's orders, every boat not commanded to bring the army across had been destroyed for 60 miles along the east bank of the river, which was no small accomplishment. But broad and swift as it was, the river could remain a barrier to Howe only so long, as Washington warned the members of Congress repeatedly in a series of urgent dispatches. "From several accounts, I am led to think the enemy are bringing boats with them," he wrote. "If so, it will be impossible for our small force to give them any considerable opposition in the passage of the river. Under the circumstances, the security of Philadelphia should be our next object." In another letter to John Hancock, he stated flatly that Philadelphia, beyond all question, is the object of the enemy's movements, that nothing less than our utmost exertions could stop Howe, and that his own force was too thin and weak to count on. Washington and his staff had taken up quarters in a brick house directly across the river from Trenton, where he hoped to keep watch on the enemy. His troops were scattered close by the river for nearly 25 miles, camped in the woods and brush out of sight from the river, the greater part of them about 10 miles to the north of Washington's headquarters. While Joseph Reed had gotten nowhere with his recruiting efforts in New Jersey, Mifflin's efforts had produced some results. The Philadelphia Volunteer Militia, or Philadelphia Associators, as they were called, that Charles Wilson Peel had arrived with, numbered 1,000, and marched into camp in a very spirited manner, as Washington noted approvingly. On December 10th, word came at last that Lee and 4,000 troops commanded by General Sullivan had reached Morristown to the northeast. "General Lee is on his march to join me," Washington wrote to the governor of Connecticut, Jonathan Trumbull. "If he can effect this junction, our army will again make a respectable appearance, and such as I hope will disappoint the enemy in their plan on Philadelphia." Everything depended on Lee. The letter to Trumbull was written December 14th, when Washington knew nothing of events of the day before, Friday the 13th, events wholly unexpected and of far-reaching consequences. As time would show, that Friday the 13th had been an exceedingly lucky day for Washington and for his country. In an inexplicable lapse of judgment, General Lee had spent the previous night of the 12th separated from his troops, stopping at a tavern about 3 miles away at Basking Ridge, for what reason is not known. With Lee was a personal guard of 15 officers and men. The next morning, in low spirits and no apparent hurry, Lee sat at a table in his dressing gown, attending to routine paperwork, then took time to write a letter to General Gates, for no other purpose than to blame Washington for all his troubles and for the woeful state of affairs in general. "Entre nous, a certain great man is damnable deficient," Lee told Gates. "He has thrown me into a situation where I have my choice of difficulties. If I stay in this province, I risk myself and army, and if I do not stay, the province is lost forever. In short, unless something which I do not expect turns up, we are lost. It was just after 10 when a swarm of British cavalry appeared suddenly at the end of the lane. They were a scouting party of 25 horsemen, commanded by Colonel William Harcourt, who had once served with Lee in Portugal. They had been sent out from Trenton by Cornwallis to gather intelligence on Lee's motions and situation. At Basking Ridge, a local loyalist had given them the answer. From the end of the lane to the tavern was a distance of about 100 yards. 6 of the horsemen, led by Lieutenant Bannister Tarleton, came at a gallop. In minutes they had the building surrounded, killed 2 of the guards, and scattered the rest. I ordered my men to fire into the house through every window and door, and cut up as many of the guard as they could, Tarleton later wrote. Some of those inside fired back. Then the owner of the tavern, a woman named White, appeared in the door. Screaming that Lee was inside, she begged for mercy. Tarleton shouted that he would burn the building unless Lee gave himself up. In a few minutes, Lee appeared and surrendered, saying he trusted he would be treated as a gentleman. A young American lieutenant who had been inside and managed to escape, James Wilkinson, would later describe how a cheer went up among Lee's captors and a trumpet sounded. Then off they dashed with their prize, the unfortunate Lee, hatless, still in his dressing gown and slippers, mounted on Wilkinson's horse, which happened to have been tethered at the door. The astonishing raid had taken no more than 15 minutes. News of Lee's capture spread in all directions as fast as the fastest horses could move. The British were jubilant. At Brunswick, where the prisoner was put under lock and key, Harcourt's cavalrymen celebrated by getting Lee's horse, Wilkinson's horse, drunk along with themselves as a band played into the night. A Hessian captain wrote in his journal, "We have captured General Lee, the only rebel general whom we had cause to fear." The hero of the hour, Lieutenant Tarleton, wrote triumphantly to his mother, "This coup de main has put an end to the campaign." When the news reached England, it was thought at first to be too improbable, then set off bell-ringing and joyful demonstrations, as if a great battle had been won. Among the British, it was thought that because Lee was a British soldier and gentleman, he was therefore, of course, superior to any raw American provincial who had assumed high rank. But then, for the same reason, he was also that much more of a traitor to his king. To the American officers and troops deployed along the west bank of the Delaware, and all those whose hopes were riding on them, the loss of Lee seemed the worst possible news at the worst possible moment. To Nathaniel Greene, it was one of a combination of evils pressing in upon us on all sides. Washington, on first hearing what had happened, called it a severe blow, then said he would comment no further on this unhappy accident. Privately, he was furious with Lee for having been such a fool. "Unhappy man, taken by his own imprudence," he told Lund Washington. And privately, he must also have breathed a sigh of relief. After the continuing frustrations and anxieties Lee had subjected him to, there must have been a feeling of deliverance for Washington. The popular, egotistical general who considered the members of Congress no better than cattle, and longed for the necessary power to set everything straight, was no longer a factor. In little time, fearing he might be hanged as a traitor, and hoping to ingratiate himself with his old military friend William Howe, Lee would resort to offering his thoughts to Howe on ways the British could win the war. The same day as Lee's capture, Washington learned that Congress had adjourned in order to move to a safer location at Baltimore. It was abandoning Philadelphia for the first time since convening there for the First Continental Congress in 1774. Everything seemed to be happening at once. On December 13th, at his Trenton headquarters across the river from Washington, William Howe made one of the fateful decisions of the war. He was suspending further military operations until spring. Beginning immediately, he and his army would retire to winter quarters in northern New Jersey and New York. To secure the ground gained in the campaign, he would establish a string of outposts in New Jersey. There'd been a change in the weather. The days had turned much colder. The nights were the coldest yet, with a hard frost and snow flurries, and this was all Howe had needed to make up his mind, the weather, as he wrote, having become too severe to keep the field. It was commonly understood that 18th-century professional armies and their gentlemen commanders did not subject themselves to the miseries of winter campaigns unless there were overriding reasons to the contrary. Considering all he had accomplished in the year's campaign, and knowing the helpless state of the rebel army, Howe saw no cause to continue the fight or to remain a day longer than necessary in a punishing American winter in a place like Trenton. And there were, besides, compelling reasons to retire to New York City, for quarters for the army and for the comforts and pleasures that so appealed to the general himself. Howe departed for New York on Saturday, December 14th, joined by Cornwallis, whom he had granted leave to return to England to visit his ailing wife. General Howe, cozily accommodated in New York as pictured in the minds of many, would rekindle old gossip and give rise to some popular doggerel. Sir William He, snug as a flea, lay all this time a-snoring, nor dreamed of harm as he lay warm, in bed with Mrs. Loring. No boats were to be built or hauled overland by the British to cross the Delaware, and for now there was to be no march on Philadelphia. The members of Congress could as well have stayed where they were. But of this Washington seems to have known little or nothing. Close as he was to the enemy, he had almost no idea of what they were doing, no knowledge that Howe and Cornwallis had departed, and that neither he nor Congress were any longer under immediate threat. The Delaware now divides what remains of our little force from that of General Howe, whose object beyond all question is to possess Philadelphia, Washington wrote on December 18th, 4 days after Howe's departure, to James Bowdoin, a member of the Massachusetts Council. Were the river to freeze, Washington feared, the enemy might attack over the ice. Strain every nerve for carrying out the necessary works, he told Israel Putnam, who was charged with the defense of Philadelphia. There seems to be the strongest reason to believe the enemy will attempt to pass the river as soon as the ice is sufficiently formed. Desperate for reliable intelligence, for information of almost any kind, Washington let it be known he was willing to pay for it at almost any price. In a dispatch to his general officers, he implored them to find a spy who would cross the river and determine whether any boats were being built or coming overland. Expense must not be spared in procuring such intelligence, and will readily be paid by me. To Lord Stirling he wrote, "Use every possible means, without regard to expense, to come with certainty at the enemy's strength, situation, and movements. Without this, we wander in a wilderness of uncertainties." As early as December 15th, he had received a report from a commander of Pennsylvania militia posted below Trenton, John Cadwallader, saying, "General Howe is certainly gone to New York, unless the whole scene is a scheme to amuse and surprise." Perhaps Washington found it impossible to believe, or suspected that it was indeed a ruse. Whatever the reason, he seems to have ignored it. The foe gathered on the other side of the river was the British Army no longer, but a holding force of 1,500 Hessians, settled in for the winter under the command of Colonel Johann Rahl, the veteran officer who had led the fierce Hessian assaults at White Plains and Fort Washington. Concerned about the apparent designs of the enemy, the wilderness of uncertainties, Washington moved his headquarters 10 miles upstream to Buckingham Township, closer to the main body of the army, where Greene, Stirling, and Knox had their headquarters. In 2 weeks, on New Year's Day, all enlistments would expire. And what then? "Our only dependence now is upon the speedy enlistment of a new army," he wrote to Lund, Washington. "If this fails, I think the game is pretty near up." On December 20th, in the midst of a snowstorm, General Sullivan rode into Buckingham at the head of Lee's troops. Having marched at a pace four times what Lee had set in order to join Washington as soon as possible. But instead of the 4,000 that Washington had been expecting, there were only half that number, and the men were in more wretched condition even than Washington's own ranks. When Lee had complained of his troops having no shoes, it had been no exaggeration for effect. General Heath would later write of seeing Lee's troops pass through Peekskill, many so destitute of shoes that the blood left on the frozen ground in many places marked the route they had taken. One of those who had made the trek from Peekskill was Lieutenant Joseph Hodgkins. In a letter headed Buckingham in Pennsylvania, December 20, 1776, Hodgkins reported to his wife Sarah, "We have been on the march since the 29th of last month, and we are now within 10 or 12 miles of General Washington's army. We expect to be there tonight. But how long we shall stay there, I can't tell. Neither can I tell you much about the enemy, only that they are on one side of the Delaware River, and our army on the other." They had marched about 200 miles, Hodgkins thought, and the greatest part of the way was dangerous, the enemy being near, but also because so much of the country was full of them cursed creatures called Tories. General Gates, too, arrived, but to Washington's disappointment, he had with him only 600 men. Before departing for Baltimore, Congress had named Robert Morris to head the committee to look after affairs in Philadelphia, by now an all but abandoned city. Writing to Morris 3 days before Christmas, Washington said he thought the enemy was waiting for two events only before marching on Philadelphia: ice for a passage, and the dissolution of the poor remains of our debilitated army. As near as could be determined, Washington now had an army of about 7,500, but that was a paper figure only. Possibly 6,000 were fit for duty. Hundreds were sick and suffering from the cold. Robert Morris and others in and around Philadelphia were doing everything possible to find winter clothes and blankets, while more and more of the local citizenry were signing the British Proclamation. Congress had fled. Two former members of Congress, Joseph Galloway and Andrew Allen, had gone over to the enemy. By all reasonable signs, the war was over and the Americans had lost. Yet for all the troubles that beset him, all the high expectations and illusions that he had seen shattered since the triumph at Boston, Washington had more strength to draw upon than met the eye. In his own inner resources, and in the abilities of those still with him and resolved to carry on. In Greene, Sterling, and Sullivan, he had field commanders as good as or better than any. Though Greene, his best, and the very able Joseph Reed had let him down, both had learned from the experience, just as Washington had, and were more determined than ever to prove themselves worthy in his eyes. Greene, as he would confide to his wife, was extremely happy to have again the full confidence of His Excellency, confidence that seemed to increase the more difficult and distressing our affairs grow. Henry Knox, a novice artilleryman no longer, and the steadfast John Glover, could be counted on, no matter how tough the going. In recognition of the part played thus far by the 26-year-old Knox, Washington had already recommended him for promotion to the rank of Brigadier General. Junior officers and soldiers in the ranks, men like Joseph Hodgkins, were battered, weary, ragged as beggars, but not beaten. Washington himself was by no means beaten. If William Howe and others of like mind thought the war was over and the British had won, Washington did not. Washington refused to see it that way. With Lee gone and Congress entrusting him with more power, Washington was fully the commander now, and it suited him. Out of adversity, he seemed to draw greater energy and determination. His Excellency George Washington, wrote Greene later, never appeared to so much advantage as in the hour of distress. His health was excellent. the loyalty of those he counted on was stronger than ever. On December 24th, the day before Christmas, Washington's judge advocate, Colonel William Tudor, who had been with him from the beginning, wrote again as he often had during the campaign, to tell his fiancée in Boston of his continuing love for her and to explain why his hopes of returning soon to Boston had vanished. "I cannot desert a man, and it would certainly be desertion in a court of honor, who has deserted everything to defend his country, and whose chief misfortune, among 10,000 others, is that a large part of it wants spirit to defend itself." Bristol, Pennsylvania, was a small town on the western side of the Delaware, downstream from Trenton, across the river from Burlington, New Jersey. It was from Bristol, where he was helping to organize Pennsylvania militia, that Joseph Reed had written a remarkable letter to Washington, dated December 22nd. "It was time something was done, something aggressive and surprising," Reed wrote. "Even failure would be preferable to doing nothing." "Will it not be possible, my dear General, for our troops, or such part of them as can act with advantage, to make a diversion or something more at or about Trenton? The greater the alarm, the more likely success will attend the attacks. I will not disguise my own sentiments that our cause is desperate and hopeless if we do not take the opportunity of the collection of troops at present to strike some stroke. Our affairs are hastening fast to ruin if we do not retrieve them by some happy event. Delay with us is now equal to total defeat." Apparently, the letter was unsolicited. What was remarkable was the degree to which it corresponded with Washington's own mind and plans. In the bleak days after the Battle of Brooklyn, Washington had told Congress, "We should on all occasions avoid a general action, or put anything to the risk unless compelled by a necessity." But he had also written of the possibility of some brilliant stroke on his part that might save the cause. On December 14th, he had written to Governor Trumbull that a lucky blow against the enemy would most certainly rouse the spirits of the people, which are quite sunk by our misfortunes. Now, compelled by necessity, his brilliant stroke worked out in his mind, he was ready to put almost everything at risk. With Greene and a few others at the Buckingham headquarters, he had been going over the plan for days, insisting on the strictest secrecy. But on December 21st, Robert Morris had written to say he had heard an attack across the Delaware was being prepared, and that he hoped this was true. Responding now to Reed, Washington confirmed that an attack on Trenton was to begin Christmas night. "For heaven's sake, keep this to yourself, as discovery of it may prove fatal to us. But necessity, dire necessity, will, nay, must, justify an attempt." On Christmas Eve, Washington called a meeting at Greene's headquarters to go over the final details. The army was to attack across the Delaware at three places: a force of 1,000 Pennsylvania militia and some 500 veteran Rhode Island troops, led by General John Cadwallader and Joseph Reed, were to cross downriver at Bristol and advance toward Burlington. A second, smaller force of 700 Pennsylvania militia, under General James Ewing, was to attack directly across the river at Trenton and hold the wooden bridge over Assunpink Creek at the foot of Queen Street, which the enemy might use as an escape route. The third and much the largest force of 2,400 of the Continental Army, led by Washington, Greene, Sullivan, and Sterling, would cross the Delaware 9 miles upstream from Trenton at McConkie's Ferry. Once over the river, Washington's army would head south, then halfway to Trenton, divide into two columns, one led by Sullivan taking the river road, the other, commanded by Greene, taking the Pennington Road farther inland. Four of Knox's cannon were to advance at the head of each column. Washington would ride with Greene. According to the latest intelligence, the enemy's force at Trenton numbered between 2,000 and 3,000 men. The first step, the crossing, was set for midnight, December 25th, Christmas night. By marching through the night, the two columns were to arrive at Trenton no later than 5 in the morning. The attack was set for 6, an hour before daylight. Officers were to have a piece of white paper in their hats to distinguish them. Absolute secrecy was demanded. A profound silence was to be observed, the orders read, and no man to quit his ranks on pain of death. Christmas Day, the weather turned ominous. A northeast storm was gathering. The river was up and filled with broken sheets of ice. In the course of the day, Joseph Reed arrived from Bristol, accompanied by Congressman and physician Benjamin Rush, who since the adjournment of Congress had reported to Reed and Cadwallader to volunteer his services. Years later, Rush would recall a private meeting with Washington at Buckingham, during which Washington seemed much depressed. In affecting terms, he described the state of the army. As they talked, Washington kept writing something with his pen on small pieces of paper. When one of them fell to the floor by Rush's foot, he saw what was written, "Victory or Death." It was to be the password for the night. When Rush, or possibly Reed, warned the general not to expect much from the militiamen under Cadwallader, Washington scratched out a note that he asked Rush to take to Cadwallader as soon as possible. "I am determined, as the night is favorable, to cross the river and make an attack on Trenton in the morning. If you can do nothing real, at least create as great a diversion as possible." The crossing of Washington's force was to be made in big flat-bottomed, high-sided Durham boats, as they were known, normally used to transport pig iron on the Delaware from the Durham Ironworks near Philadelphia. Painted black and pointed at both ends, they were 40 to 60 feet long, with a beam of 8 feet. The biggest of them could carry as many as 40 men standing up, and fully loaded, they drew only about 2 feet, and so could be brought close to shore. The oars, or sweeps, used to propel the boats were 18 feet long. Henry Knox was to organize and direct the crossing, and the biggest, most difficult part of the task, as he knew, would be transporting 18 field cannon and 50 horses or more, including those of the officers. Again, as at Brooklyn, John Glover and his men were in charge of the boats. Before leaving his headquarters to lead the march, Washington, in what seems to have been a state of perfect calm, wrote to Robert Morris, "I agree with you that it is vain to ruminate upon, or even reflect upon, the authors of our present misfortunes. We should rather exert ourselves and look forward with hopes that some lucky chance may yet turn up in our favor." Drums rolled in the camps, and starting about 2 in the afternoon, the army began moving out for the river, each man carrying 60 rounds of ammunition and food enough for 3 days. It was nearly dark and raining when the first troops reached McConkie's Ferry, where the boats waited. Henry Knox's unmistakable bass voice could be heard bellowing orders above the rising wind and rain. According to one account, had it not been for the powerful lungs and extraordinary exertions of Knox, the crossing that night would have failed. Knox himself later praised the heroic efforts of Glover and his men, describing how ice in the river made their labor almost incredible, and the almost infinite difficulty they had getting the horses and cannon on board the boats. The Delaware was not so broad at McConkie's Ferry as at Trenton or below Trenton, where it became a tidal estuary. Under normal conditions, the width of the river at McConkie's Ferry was about 800 feet. But with the water as high as it was that night, the distance was greater by 50 feet or more, and the current strong, the ice formidable, as all accounts attest. Glover's men used oars and poles to get the big boats across. The troops went standing, packed on board as close as possible. Washington crossed early and watched the slow process from the New Jersey side. About 11 o'clock, the storm struck, a full-blown northeaster. Among the most vivid first-hand accounts of the night was that of John Greenwood, the young fifer from Boston, who, after the march to New York in April, had been sent off to serve in Canada and had only just rejoined Washington's army. Fife's not being a priority under the circumstances, 16-year-old Greenwood carried a musket like every other man and crossed in one of the first boats. "Over the river we then went in a flat-bottomed scow," he wrote, "and we had to wait for the rest and so began to pull down fences and make fires to warm ourselves, for the storm was increasing rapidly. After a while it rained, hailed, snowed, and froze, and at the same time blew a perfect hurricane, so much so that I perfectly recollect, after putting the rails on to burn, the wind and fire would cut them in two in a moment, and when I turned my face to the fire, my back would be freezing. However, by turning myself round and round, I kept myself from perishing." As during the escape from Brooklyn, Washington's other daring river crossing by night, a northeaster was again decisively a blessing and a curse. A blessing in that it covered the noise of the crossing, a curse in that with the ice on the river, it was badly slowing progress when time was of the essence. The plan was to have the whole army over the river no later than midnight, in order to reach Trenton before dawn. According to Washington, it was 3 o'clock, 3 hours behind schedule, before the last of the troops, horses, and cannon were across. At that point, the attack might have been called off, the men sent back over the river, since the entire plan rested on the element of surprise, and the chances for surprise now seemed gone. It was a decision that could not be delayed and involved great risk either way. Washington decided without hesitation, as he would explain succinctly to John Hancock, "I well knew we could not reach Trenton before day was fairly broke. But as I was certain there was no making a retreat without being discovered and harassed on repassing the river, I determined to push on at all events." Downstream, as he had no way of knowing, the other part of his plan was failing badly. General Ewing had called off his attack on Trenton because of ice in the river. At Bristol, where ice was piled higher even than at Trenton, Cadwallader and Reed had succeeded in getting some of their troops over to the other side, but then, unable to move their cannon across, they too had called off the attack. "It was as severe a night as I ever saw," wrote an officer with Cadwallader, "and after two battalions were landed, the storm increased so much that it was impossible to get the artillery over, for we had to walk 100 yards on the ice to get on shore." General Cadwallader, therefore, ordered the whole to retreat again, and we had to stand at least 6 hours under arms, first to cover the landing, and till all the rest had retreated again. And by this time, the storm of wind, rain, hail, and snow with ice was so bad that some of the infantry could not get back till the next day. Unable to recross the ice with their horses, Reed and another officer chose to stay on the New Jersey side, concealed in the house of a friend. Thus, of the three planned attacks on the enemy, only one was moving forward, and it perilously behind schedule. The march south from McConkie's Ferry was for many the most harrowing part of the night. The storm grew worse with cold driving rain, sleet, snow, and violent hail. The troops, as Henry Knox wrote, pushed on with the most profound silence. For the first half mile or more, the dark road from the ferry was a steep uphill climb. After another 2 miles, the road dropped into a ravine and crossed Jacob's Creek. John Greenwood remembered moving no faster than a child could walk, stopping frequently and suffering terribly from the cold. "I recollect very well that at one time, when we halted on the road, I sat down on the stump of a tree and was so benumbed with cold that I wanted to go to sleep. Had I been passed unnoticed, I should have frozen to death without knowing it." In fact, in the course of the night, two of the men did freeze to death. There was little light to see by. A few men carried lanterns, and torches were mounted on some of the cannon. The entire 2,400 on the march kept together for 5 miles, as far as a little crossroads called Birmingham, where the army divided, Sullivan's column keeping to the right on the river road, while Washington's and Greene's force veered off to the left on the Pennington road, both routes slick with ice and snow. The distance to Trenton was the same either way, about 4 miles. Men and horses kept slipping and skidding in the dark. A Connecticut lieutenant, Elisha Bostwick, remembered Washington coming along on his horse, telling the men in a deep and solemn voice to keep with their officers. For God's sake, keep with your officers. When his army had marched out of Boston, heading for New York and their first field of battle, the commander-in-chief had traveled by coach. Much of the time since, he had conducted the war from established headquarters in elegant houses. And though he had been with the army the night of the escape from Brooklyn and through the retreat across New Jersey, until now he had never been with them as a field commander on the attack. When handed a message from General Sullivan saying that the men had found their guns too soaked to fire, Washington answered, "Tell the general to use the bayonet." "None but the first officers knew where we were going or what we were about," John Greenwood wrote. This was not unusual, however, as I never heard soldiers say anything, nor ever saw them trouble themselves, as to where they were or where they were led. It was enough for them to know that wherever the officers commanded, they must go. For it was all the same, owing to the impossibility of being in a worse condition than their present one, and therefore the men always liked to be kept moving in the expectation of bettering themselves. The two columns reached their assigned positions outside Trenton at about the same time, a few minutes before 8, an hour after daylight. Trenton was often referred to as a pretty village, which was an exaggeration. With perhaps 100 houses, an Episcopal church, a marketplace, and 2 or 3 mills and iron furnaces, it was in peacetime a busy but plain little place of no particular consequence, except that it was at the head of navigation on the river and a stop on the King's Highway from New York to Philadelphia. There was also a large 2-story stone barracks built during the French and Indian War, and the bridge over Assunpink Creek below town. The principal streets were King Street and Queen Street, which ran parallel toward the river, sloping downhill from the point above town where the Pennington Road and the King's Highway converged. By Washington's plan of attack, this point, the head of King and Queen Streets, would decide the day. But in the early light of December 26th, in the white blur of the continuing storm, it was difficult to distinguish much of anything about Trenton. Most of the townspeople had fled, taking as much as possible of their belongings. In the bare houses and the stone barracks were quartered the 1,500 Hessians who occupied the town. Their commander, Colonel Rawl, had established himself in an ample frame house on King Street, the home of an owner of an iron furnace, Stacy Potts, who was happy to have the colonel as his guest. Johann Gottlieb Rawl was a sturdy, able career soldier, and at age 56 a senior among officers. The command at Trenton had been conferred in recognition of his valor at White Plains and Fort Washington. He was a man of limited imagination. He spoke little or no English, and had only contempt for the rebel army. His pleasures were a game of cards, a good drink or two, and martial music, which he relished to the point of absurdity, marching himself with his military band at almost any excuse. Rawl would be roundly criticized later by some of his junior officers for being lazy, lax, indifferent to the possibility of surprise attack, and a drunkard. Captain Johann Ewald, as fair-minded as any Hessian officer who served in America, later wrote that many who criticized Rawl after his death were not fit to have carried his sword. Harassed by rebel patrols that kept coming over the Delaware, Rawl had established outposts beyond the town, and insisted that each night one company sleep with its muskets ready to be called out at a moment's notice. And they were called out, it seemed to some, more often than necessary. If anything, the colonel was thought to be too much on edge. An officer complained in his diary, "We've not slept one night in peace since we came to this place." It was the size of the attack to come, and in such weather, that Rawl did not anticipate. And in this he was not alone. Before departing for New York, General Howe had put James Grant in overall command of the string of outposts in New Jersey. Grant was at Brunswick, 25 miles from Trenton. On December 24th, he received certain intelligence that the rebels were planning an attack on Trenton. While he did not think them equal to the attempt, he alerted Rawl, telling him to be on guard. Rawl received the message at 5 o'clock the afternoon of the 25th. Not long after, a dozen Hessians on guard on the Pennington Road beyond town were fired on in the dark by an American patrol, which had quickly withdrawn. Rawl himself rode out through the storm to look things over, and concluded that this was the attack he had been warned about. On such a night, he assumed nothing more would happen. Later in the evening, Rawl attended a small Christmas gathering at the home of a local merchant and was playing cards when, reportedly, a servant interrupted to deliver still another warning message that had been delivered to the door by an unknown loyalist, and this Rawl is said to have thrust into his pocket. It is not known what time he returned to his quarters or whether, as later said, he had had too much to drink. The attack began just after 8 o'clock. The Americans under Nathaniel Greene came out of the woods and across a field through driving snow about half a mile from town. They were moving fast at what was called a long trot. The Hessians on guard on the Pennington Road had trouble at first making out who they were and how many there were. The storm continued with great violence, Henry Knox wrote, but was in our backs and consequently in the faces of the enemy. The Americans opened fire. The Hessians waited for them to get closer, then fired, and began quickly, smoothly falling back into town, exactly as they had been trained to do when retreat was the only choice. Washington thought they performed particularly well, keeping up a steady, retreating fire. As Greene's and Sullivan's columns converged on the town, Washington moved to high ground nearby on the north, where he tried to keep watch on what was happening. His 2,400 Americans, having been on their feet all night, wet, cold, their weapons soaked, went into the fight as if everything depended on them. Each man seemed to vie with the other in pressing forward, Washington wrote. In town, the Hessians came rushing out of their houses and barracks into the streets. Drums beat, the band played. Officers shouted orders in German, and as fast as the Hessians began forming up, Knox's artillery were in position at the head of King and Queen Streets. The cannon opened fire with deadly effect down hundreds of yards on each street, and in minutes, in the twinkling of an eye, Knox said, cleared the streets. When the Hessians retreated into the side streets, they found Sullivan's men coming at them with fixed bayonets. For a brief time, 1,000 or more Americans and Hessians were locked in savage house-to-house fighting. It was all happening extremely fast, in wild confusion and swirling snow, made more blinding by clouds of gunpowder smoke. The storm of nature and the storm of the town, wrote Nathaniel Greene, exhibited a scene that filled the mind during the action with passions easier conceived than described. When the Hessians rolled out a field gun midway on King Street, a half-dozen Virginians, led by Captain William Washington, a distant cousin of the commander, and Lieutenant James Monroe, rushed forward, seized it, and turned it on them. Colonel Rawl, who had been rousted from his bed and was quickly on horseback and in command in the midst of the fray, ordered a charge. Men were being hit all around him. The line faltered. He ordered a retreat into an orchard at the southeast edge of town. Then Rawl, too, was hit and fell from his horse. Mortally wounded, he was picked up and carried to the Potts house. The Hessians in the orchard, finding themselves surrounded, lay down their arms and surrendered. It all happened in 45 minutes or less. 21 Hessians had been killed, 90 wounded. The prisoners taken numbered approximately 900. Another 500 had managed to escape, most of them by the bridge over Assunpink Creek. Incredibly, in a battle of such extreme savagery, only 4 Americans had been wounded, including Captain Washington and Lieutenant Monroe, and not one American had been killed. The only American fatalities were the 2 soldiers who had frozen to death during the night on the road. After having marched off the prisoners and secured the cannon, stores, and so forth, wrote Knox, we returned to the place 9 miles distant where we had embarked. Thus, after marching through the night a second time, back to McConkie's Ferry, the army crossed the Delaware once again, back to the Pennsylvania side of